All right, today we begin a study of the book of Esther. I'd like for you to turn there in your Bibles. It's the last of the historical books in our arrangements in the English Bible, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. That's not the way the Hebrew Bible is arranged, and maybe at some point I'll make a comment on that. But I'm going to read the first chapter of the book of Esther. Today my plan is to introduce the book, and I hope also to make comments on chapter 1. Please give attention to Esther chapter 1. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. In those days when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the citadel, that in the third year of his reign he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him, when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. And when these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan, the citadel, from great to small, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white and blue linen curtains fastened with cords of fine linen and purple on silver rods and marble pillars, and the couches were of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of alabaster, turquoise, and white and black marble. And they served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other, with royal wine in abundance, according to the generosity of the king. In accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory, for so the king had ordered all the officials of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. Queen Vashti also made a feast for the women in the royal palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zathar, and Carcas, 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown, in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, brought by his eunuchs. Therefore the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for this was the king's manner toward all who knew law and justice, those closest to him being Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Merez, Marsina, and Memucan, the 7 princes of Persia and Media, who had access to the king's presence and who ranked highest in the kingdom. What shall we do to Queen Vashti, according to law, because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus brought to her by the eunuchs? And Memucan answered before the king and the princes, Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will become known to all women, so that they will despise their husbands in their eyes when they report, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought in before him, but she did not come. This very day the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials that they have heard of the behavior of the queen. Thus there will be excessive contempt and wrath. If it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him, and let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it will not be altered, that Vashti shall no more come before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another, who is better than she. When the king's decree, which he will make, is proclaimed throughout all his empire, for it is great, all wives will honor their husbands, both great and small. And the reply pleased the king and the princes, and the king did according to the word of Memucan. Then he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province in its own script, and to every people in their own language, that each man should be master in his own house and speak in the language of his own people. The book of Esther is about God's remarkable acts of providence in delivering his people from the destruction that was plotted against them. I want to talk a little bit about the historical background of the book before I come back to that main theme and maybe give a little bit of an explanation about why I wanted to study this book. First, let me emphasize that a historical background is appropriate. This is not written as a fable, The opening phrase, "it came to pass," is the same opening phrase that's used at the beginning of Joshua and Judges. The writer is expecting us to read this as history. There are many points at which the book of Esther has been challenged by critics of Scripture as being unhistorical, and I'll make a comment on a few of those. But clearly the intention here is for us to understand this as history. And so we need to remember where we are in the history of redemption, what God has been doing, and in particular what these people are doing in these places with these guys with all these funny names. Okay, so I put up a brief, very brief background, and some of these dates you'll see varying a little bit. But in about 586 BC, the temple was destroyed by the Babylonians. The southern kingdom, which was the only kingdom still surviving at that point of the nation, was sent into exile by the Babylonians and remained in exile for a long period of time. At a later period, the Medo-Persian Empire, so that's an alliance of the Medes and the Persians, you see a reference to the Medes and the Persians in verse 3, they came to power, they conquered Babylon, and Cyrus, who was the ruler, commanded that the Jews be allowed to return to the Promised Land. So that was about 537 BC. You'll remember from this history that, in fact, many stayed behind. And what we're reading about in the book of Esther is the people who stayed behind, or rather their descendants. So these are people who have not returned to the Promised Land, but have stayed behind in Babylon, or in this case, in Persia. Now, just a brief history of the ruler. So Cyrus, I mentioned, Darius was the next in line after Cyrus. He's mentioned in Ezra and Nehemiah and elsewhere in the Bible. Darius's son, Xerxes I, is probably the Ahasuerus who's mentioned here. There is also a Xerxes II and an Artaxerxes and so on, and some of those come up later on in the scriptures, in the accounts of Ezra and Nehemiah and so on. But I stopped the history there. So Xerxes I ruled roughly from 486 to 465 BC. Okay, so I want you to think about that. It's important for us to ground this account in the history of redemption. So it says in verse 3 that this is in the third year of the reign of King Ahasuerus. Okay, so it's been about 50 years since Cyrus' decree. That's how much time has passed since the opportunity to return to the Promised Land came, and for these people, went. Yes?
Did you say 55
years? Yeah, in rough terms. Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit more than that, but 50 years. Okay? So it's been a long time. These people have, in a sense, settled down in an alien land, away from the working of God's providence, especially toward the good of his people and their worship in Jerusalem. Okay, so in terms of the history of redemption, the center of action is where God reestablishes his worship in Jerusalem. And these people are miles and miles away from that. They're isolated. Okay? And in some sense, you might think that God, or they might think that God had forgotten them. And one of the points of the book of Esther is that God never forgets his people. Of course, the plot to destroy the Jews would have affected everyone, including those in the Promised Land. But here we see that even in the centers of power where God's people remain, God is still working. So that's something of the grounding in history. The actual connection between this Ahasuerus and Xerxes is not completely clear. Some people date this to a later king, and I'm not going to go into the details of that, but it really seems to fit. Ahasuerus is supposedly the Hebrew version of the ancient Persian name, okay? But and the Greeks transliterated it a different way into Xerxes. They don't really look very much alike, but that's supposedly one connection. But the dating seems to fit pretty well, and the description of the events seems to fit also. Now, this Xerxes, Ahasuerus, whatever you want to call him, like his father, attempted to conquer Greece. Greece was an established power, and he and his father both attempted and failed to conquer Greece. It was only later on that the conflict came to a head, and ultimately Alexander the Great, much later than this, conquered Persia and Media and a lot of the known world. But this is then a time when the Persian Empire is not only great in extent, as it says here, from India to Ethiopia. Okay, I want you to let that settle in. That is a huge chunk of geography, okay, from India to Ethiopia, but even attempting to expand further to conquer Greece. So that's something of the background of the book and where it sits in the history of redemption. Now, I'm assuming that you're somewhat familiar with the story. I'm not going to retell it all now, but it is one story, and that's one difficulty in teaching about it week by week. There's really one story and different themes that are woven into the story. But what happens is that one of the king's servants seeks to destroy the Jews because of a grudge, you might say, against one Jew in particular. And that plot to destroy the Jews is ultimately frustrated by the one against whom the grudge was held, who is Mordecai, and his cousin Esther, who ultimately becomes the queen in place of the Vashti we read about here. So the plot to exterminate the Jews, the Holocaust that was planned against the Jews is frustrated, and God uses especially these two people, Esther and Mordecai, to accomplish that. And in the end, the book gives an explanation of why there is this feast, Purim, which is celebrated every year, reflecting on the events that occurred. Just as a footnote, in 2011, Purim begins at sunset on March the 19th, which was yesterday evening. No, I did not plan it this way, but in fact, Purim lasts from yesterday evening through tonight. And the Jews are celebrating the deliverance that is described in this book. Because they're on a lunar calendar, the actual day floats a little bit. But that's the Feast of Purim, which is mentioned at the end of the book here, is in celebration of that deliverance. Now, what's the significance of the book? Is it just an interesting story about how the Jews dodged a bullet? No, it's part of a much longer and bigger story of God's purposes in the history of redemption. And here, I think what I'm going to do is talk about this a little bit now, and then as we go through, just remind you of some of the bigger picture. So for now, let's just turn to Genesis, just a couple of references. Start with Genesis chapter 12. The question is, where does this fit in the history of redemption? Why is this a significant book in terms of God's dealing with his people? And the short answer is that God had promised that he would preserve the children of Abraham until the coming of the Messiah. So Genesis 12, beginning at verse 1, here is a statement of the promise, one statement of the Abrahamic covenant. Genesis 12, 1, "Now the Lord had said to Abram, 'Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.'" Now, ultimately, the promise that all the families of the earth would be blessed in Abram is fulfilled in the coming of the Messiah, in the seed of Abraham that would be the blessing to all of the nations. That promise of Abraham was sure. It was certain. And to make sure it would come about, God said he would bless those who blessed Abraham, and he would curse those who curse him. And Haman, the enemy of God's people, finds to his peril that that's true. God did curse the one who attempted to curse God's people. But you should see this promise to Abraham even as part of an earlier promise, the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent, given back in Genesis 3. The seed of the serpent would continually be seeking to destroy the seed of the woman in opposition to the coming Messiah. But God promises to bless and preserve his people. And that promise can be traced all the way from Genesis to Revelation. And I'm not kidding. Literally, there are references pretty much all the way through. But let's turn to one reference in 2 Chronicles 21. So just go back from Esther. A couple of books, three books. So we're reading along in 2 Chronicles. And we have some good kings in the southern kingdom. And we have some bad kings in the southern kingdom. And God is very patient even with the bad kings. So here's a reference to Jehoram. 2 Chronicles 21. And I won't read the whole of the passage, but let me pick up at verse 5. Jehoram was 32 years old when he became king, and he reigned 8 years in Jerusalem. And he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, just as the house of Ahab had done, for he had the daughter of Ahab as a wife, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord. Yet the Lord would not destroy the house of David, because of the covenant that he had made with David, and since he had promised to give a lamp to him and to his sons forever. You see, there's the further development of that promise. There was the Abrahamic covenant. It was worked out further in the Mosaic covenant and the establishment of the nation. And now, under the Davidic covenant, there is a specific line of kings who will ultimately issue in the Messiah. And God restrains his hand of judgment on Jehoram. Why? Well, because he had made a promise that the Messiah would come, and that he would give a lamp. So that's imagery that's used earlier in the account of the kings. He would give David a lamp, give a lamp to him and to his sons forever. So those are just a couple of examples of the promises given by God that he will preserve the Jews, and in particular the line of the Messiah, until the coming of the Messiah. So that's how the book fits into the history of redemption. Now, there's one point which, if you're tracking with me, you'll realize right away. That is that the book of Esther says nothing about this. To understand what's going on in the bigger history of redemption, you have to read outside of the book of Esther, which is not that unusual. You need to read the whole of the Bible to understand the story of the Bible. But Esther says nothing whatsoever about this. Esther never mentions the name of God. Esther never refers to prayer. There is a reference to fasting and crying. Maybe the crying is crying out to God, but it's really a very muted sort of reference to what God is doing. And that's caused a lot of people problems. Okay? Some people, everyone picks on Luther, you know, says, well, this book is, it's really not that worthwhile. I'm not sure why it's in the canon. But, in fact, the book is a very important part of the canon. So let me talk about that a little bit now, and again try to emphasize the point that we need to keep in mind as we read the book. Why is the book written this way? Well, God knows that I don't, but one reason probably is that this way of presenting the book underlines the fact that God's people, who are especially on the stage here, are cut off from the revelation of God in terms of the prophets and in terms of the worship that was established. They are outside of the main working of God in terms of his establishment of reestablishment of the temple, a point I've already made. They are, in a sense, on a side stage, and they could well have felt that God didn't deal with them directly. And that's probably part of the reason the book is written this way, to emphasize this sense of alienation, the sense of uncertainty about what God was doing. In the end, the book communicates very clearly what God is doing for those who understand the revelation of God. And by the way, that's one reason why I thought this book would be very helpful for us to study. Where are we in the stages of the history of redemption? Well, we don't have the chronicler telling us what he told us in 2 Chronicles 21. Right? When we see something bad happen in the church, we don't see the chronicler stepping in and saying, by the way, this happened because God really wanted to destroy this president or this ministry or this or that, but he didn't because he had this promise. We don't have that detailed revelation of what God is doing that you see in some of the other historical books, like in Kings and Chronicles, especially in Chronicles. Instead, we're in some sense in a similar position to the people in Esther's time, in some sense, and that we often are bewildered when we look around us, and we often wonder, what is God doing? Why are things happening this way? And we therefore need to learn to read our own history the way we read the book of Esther. That is, by not forgetting the promises that God has made. That's a very important thing for us to do individually. God promises that he will not forsake the work of his hands. He will persevere in us to the end. But there may be times when we feel like we're just about done and that God has forgotten us. God has taken away our friends. We can't accomplish what we want to in our lives. There may be times like that where we need to remember the promises of God. Remember that God has declared what he will do with us and not be discouraged. But I especially want to emphasize the corporate aspect. Not only the individual aspect, but the corporate aspect. Many times we look around the world and we see the church suffering under cruel rulers. We see the church limping along, tested by false doctrine. And we need to be reminded of the promise of God, that God will accomplish a good end. As Paul says in Ephesians 1:22, Christ is put as head over all things for his church. If Christ is really the head over all things for the good of his church, then a good end will be accomplished. And so we need to read history the way we read Esther. I mean, read our own history, our own dealings. That is, ever keeping in mind the promises of God, and ever keeping in mind that God works in very remarkable ways to accomplish his purposes. I said earlier that God worked this deliverance through Esther and Mordecai. But in fact, you remember what the turning point of the story? What is the one hinge on which the story turns? It was that the king couldn't sleep. Now, only God could turn insomnia into deliverance for his people. And that we need to remember. There are various things around us that seem completely random. But from God's point of view, nothing is random. Maybe he had bad pizza. You know, maybe he just was worried about things in his far-flung empire. The account doesn't tell us. But God used that apparently insignificant fact of a sleepless night to turn the thing around. And he also used Mordecai and Esther. That's the most important thing for us to remember when we study the book of Esther. Let me emphasize this point. It's easy to get bogged down in the book of Esther into a sort of moralism. Okay, was Esther really supposed to be in the king's harem? Was it really a good idea for Esther to deny that she was a Jew? Should Mordecai have bowed to Haman, and then maybe we wouldn't have had this problem? Okay, there are all kinds of questions like that that the book doesn't answer. And we'll probably talk about them because it's almost impossible not to. But those questions really miss the main point. The main point of the book is that God is sovereign and God works out his providence for the good of his people in ways that are really beyond our comprehension. Now, I want to bring that back to chapter 1. There are some other lessons that are associated with that I think are worth mentioning. For this, I'll quote from McCree. This is Thomas McCree, who's known for writing interesting books about history and about the unity of the church and so on. But McCree also gave some lectures on Esther, and he adds this point. The watchful care which God exerts over his people in times of danger is the chief lesson which we are taught by this portion of sacred history. But it is not the only lesson which it supplies. It lays open to us the wonderful manner in which he who declares the end from the beginning provides beforehand for the execution of his purposes, for defeating the schemes of his adversaries and rescuing those who put their trust in him. It shows how easy it is for him to put down the mighty from their seats and to exalt them of low degree. how slippery is the path of ambition, and how deceitful the gale of prosperity, which raises its devotees aloft that it may dash them with greater severity to the ground, and how much more safe it is to put our trust in God and walk humbly with Him. That theme of casting down the proud and raising up the lowly is, of course, found elsewhere in Scripture, but it's quite prominent in the book of Esther. So I want to encourage you as we go through that you see how each part of the story serves that writer's purpose to emphasize the sovereign purpose of God to deliver His people. Okay, let me pause and see if I can get my throat to keep working and see if you have any comments or questions so far. Is the main point clear? Everyone with me? Okay. Let's look at chapter 1 then. Chapter 1 describes at the beginning a 6-month-long feast. Now, there is actually a historical record that about this time Xerxes was planning for the invasion of Greece, and he had a war council. This was one way to get everyone excited about fighting against Greece, get them all ready for the battle. He showed them the greatness of his power. He fed them well. There's an emphasis here, and I'll come back to this point, on the abundance, the richness of the kingdom. Everyone had a unique vessel. Okay, they weren't all Eskimo Joe's plastic cups. They were varied. And it was a very impressive scene. And at the end of that, as a sort of show of appreciation to the locals, he made a feast for 7 days for the people in Shushan. Now, Shushan, or Susa, was one of 4 capitals of Persia. It's in what is now Iran. Persians and Iranians are the same people, pretty much. And this was the winter capital then, which is referred to here. So there was a feast and lots of wine available. It may seem sort of strange to us to have a war council while everyone is inebriated or close thereto. However, the main source of extra-biblical history from this time, who is Herodotus, says that this is the way the Persians made their plans. They got drunk, and then they deliberated, and the next day when they were sober, if they liked what they had done the day before, they ratified it and acted on it. And sometimes they did it the other way around. They were sober and made a plan, and then when you're drunk, they would see if that was a good idea or not. Okay? This is not a Jew criticizing. This is a Greek historian, Herodotus, the most famous historian of the time. Roughly contemporary with the events here. Anyway, okay, there is then a great description of the wealth here. And I want to emphasize that point, so let me come back to that now. The writer is communicating something to us that we shouldn't miss. Esther is written in a very beautiful way, and you should, and at one level, analyze it the way you would analyze any other well-written book. What is it he's trying to say to us? He's trying to say to us that this was a very impressive empire. Okay, from India to Ethiopia, amazing riches, and this is confirmed. Actually, Xerxes lost most of his riches in the failed attempt to conquer Greece, but his son built up great riches, and Herodotus recorded the great riches of that, or rather, the riches that were recorded when Alexander the Great conquered later on. We are supposed to be impressed by the greatness of the power of this kingdom. Now you see how that serves the writer's purpose. Okay, who could stand against a kingdom like this? This guy rules from India to Ethiopia. It seems impossible that the Jews could retain their identity in the midst of such great power and such great wealth. They had given up their own wealth in rebellion against God. Their temple had been destroyed, and now they have to serve the wealth of another king, of a pagan king. And not only a pagan king, but also an arbitrary pagan king. So now we come to the story about Vashti, beginning in verse 9. Vashti was the queen, the king whose heart was merry with wine, it says in verse 10, called for Vashti to appear before him. Now the Persians had a sense of propriety, so Vashti had a feast for the women in a separate place, and all the men were with King Xerxes, Ahasuerus. But when his heart is merry, he calls the queen in. The Puritan commentator Trapp says, "The wine was so in that the wit was out," as a description of Xerxes, which is a fair description of Xerxes. It was a stupid thing to do, and Vashti refuses to come before the king. The king is furious, his anger burns within him, and he calls a council then. These fellows actually have access to the king's presence, so unlike the queen, who has to have approval to come before the king, these guys can come to the king at any time. He calls them, and he asks what we should do. And this one fellow in particular says that what you should do is tell the whole world what just happened to you. And also tell the whole world that the wives shouldn't act that way, but that the husbands should be obeyed by the wives. So that's what is decreed. Verse 19, "If it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him, and let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it will not be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. When the king's decree, which he will make, is proclaimed throughout all his empire, for it is great, all wives will honor their husbands, both great and small." And so it says in the last part of the book that letters are sent out to all the provinces saying that each man should be master in his own house. Now again, the point of the story is to prepare us for what will come. And what will come is that Vashti will be replaced by a Jewess, by Esther. And so that's really, in a sense, the main point of telling us this story. The writer wants to show us the glory of the kingdom, but he especially wants to show us how it is that Esther came to her position. And again, let me read from Trapp. Trapp is very witty and says very well, makes very well the point that the writer is making here. "Vashti is all of a sudden divorced, and the foolish king publicly shamed. But all this was of the Lord, that Esther might be advanced and the church relieved. So there was a wheel within a wheel," allusion to Ezekiel, "which the wicked discern not, nor the saints consider of. God oft wraps himself in a cloud, and will not be seen till afterwards. All God's dealings will appear beautiful in their seasons, though for the present we see not the connection of one thing with another." Okay. To the Jew who was watching this event, it was just some random thing that the king did while he was inebriated. What did it matter to him that this one queen was to be replaced by another? But it was part of God's amazing purpose to bring about deliverance, even ahead of the event that would trigger the terrible decree against the Jews. So that's the main point of the chapter. We've already seen the greatness of the wealth and power of the kingdom, but the main point is that we would see that God, even in an apparently foolish but somewhat random act of a king, has a purpose in mind. Let me make a couple of other comments on this. Many commentators have noted the absurdity of this decree. Okay, so Trapp already referred to it as a foolish thing that the king had done. And it does seem rather strange, doesn't it, that if the king and his counselors are worried that all the women of the empire would submit to their husbands and they wouldn't do what Vashti had done, that they would go to all these lengths to publicize what Vashti has done. Okay, so that's a sort of a strange thing, and again, I'll read from what Trapp has said. But why should any such thing be published at all, unless the king be ambitious of his own utter dishonor? Is there none wiser than other, but that the king must betray his own nest, tell all the empire that he was drunk or little better, and did in his drink determine that against his fair queen, that he soon after repented? Had Ahasuerus been wise, the world had never been the wiser for anything that Vashti had done. That raises an important point, which we may not be very tuned into, but I think the Jews are probably more tuned into this when they read the book than we are. And that is, the book of Esther contains much subtle humor, irony, satire, however you want to describe it. It's not the typical American sense of humor. It's fairly subtle, but it's a complementary thing to this glory, this overwhelming power of the king, and that is, there is incompetence at the highest level here. Okay? You're living in a vast and powerful kingdom. You're a Jew. You're not sure what's going to happen next. But these people are incompetent. Even the king's advisors can't come up with a wise decree. Now, that's a little bit scary, unless you believe in the providence of God. But it also helps you deal with your history. Okay? You can realize that God does, in fact, do what he says in Psalm 2. The nations rage, and God laughs. This guy may rule from India to Ethiopia, but he can't even write a well-worded memo. He can't even communicate the sort of submission that he expects to have his wife to have to him. We'll see more of this as we go along. There are other examples, too, that are less apparent. There's a whole book by a Jewish writer on humor in the what we call the Old Testament. And at one point, he says, well, King Ahasuerus doesn't really mean anything in Hebrew. But the closest translation into English would be something like King Headache. So even the name is sort of a funny name in Hebrew. It's the whole tenor of the book is to say, yes, the kingdom is powerful. Yes, the kingdom is something to fear in a sense. But also, we should realize that they are only fools before God. And God will accomplish his purpose. Let me make one other comment, and then I'll stop. And that is, I think that'll be about what my voice can take. I want to make a comment about the husband-wife relationships that seem to be in view here. Okay, so if you read commentators, some of them sort of take the bait and go on and on about how husbands and wives are supposed to be related to each other. My reaction is that if we want to learn about husbands and wives, we shouldn't read what Ahasuerus did with Vashti. Okay? It's not a good example for us to follow. Okay? Nor, and I've been sort of poking fun at them, nor is the decree that was sent out a good example. Right? You should read Proverbs. You should read the book of Ephesians. There are lots of places where we can learn about how husbands and wives are to relate to each other. But I thought I would read a quotation to you. This again is from Trapp. I read contemporary commentators too, but they're not nearly as quotable. Trapp's a lot better. The next time one of your professors tells you that the Puritans taught husbands to beat their wives or something ridiculous like that, okay, just pull out Trapp. This is what Trapp says about this: how stupid this decree is in terms of just how husbands and wives are to relate to each other. He asks, but will terror breed true honor? It's a good question, right? The king had cast Vashti out of his presence, and she's supposed to be the example for all the husbands in the realm. That is, now all the wives are supposed to be afraid because their husband's going to divorce them. And Trapp asks, but will terror breed true honor? People honor none to speak properly, but whom they love sincerely. those lordly husbands that domineer over their wives as if they were their slaves and carry themselves like lions in their houses must not look for any great respect there. Those husbands that will be honored indeed by their wives must give honor to them as to the weaker vessels, as being heirs together of the grace of life. Quoting from 1 Peter 3:7. Okay. Just a little Puritan lesson in domestic piety. They weren't in favor of husbands lording it over their wives in the sense that is often taken. Any comments or questions? Is anyone out there? Okay. Hope that was picked up by the recorder so they'll know I wasn't talking to an empty room. All right. Let's close in prayer.